Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. From freezing Westchester, it's 19 degrees out, but the sun's shining. And we have author, award-winning author John Land here, Murder at the CDC. Oh, my God, is this great. I'm going to just read something from the flap. Military transport on a secret run to dispose of its deadly contents vanishes without a trace. I'm not going to read where it says in the present because I don't know if that's correct. But we're going to talk about Robert Brixton, and we're going to find out he's on a trail to cover behind a shooting at his grandson's school. So, hi, how you doing?
Fran, it's publication day. If I'm not doing good today, when am I going to be doing good?
You are doing great. And I'm going to post the review later with 100 stars. At least 100.
100 stars! Oh, my God, I should bank some of those for future books.
Yes, they're coming out of the woodwork, people. My show's booked to the end of June. I got nothing after that. Nothing. It's like unbelievable. And the funny part is that people whose books I read years ago just saying, could you review my book? And go, who are you? So how did you create the prologue, and why is this so important to what happens next? Because that was scary.
That's as always, a great question. Great question to start with. And I wanted to do, you know, there are classic thriller tropes. There are things that fans of the genre not only come to expect, but revel in. And the big prologue, something that happens in the past that comes to have a distinct effect on the present. You know, as they say, good writers borrow, great writers steal. I stole that from Clive Cussler and Robert Ludlum in their primes, writing in the 70s and 80s. Once you read the prologue of a Cussler book or a Ludlum book back then, you could not stop reading.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion of some, you don't know what's in this tanker, and that's the beauty of it. You just know it's called a Red Dog Run, which means it's a high-security transport to get rid of something that is extremely deadly and dangerous. And the fact that it vanishes, just drops off the face of the earth, totally disappears. What happened to it? And what happens if somebody finds it? To me, that's the MacGuffin, what Alfred Hitchcock called the MacGuffin. What is everybody after? What is propelling the plot? And that's goes to answer the second part of your question. That's how it fits into. It's the driving force. It's the impetus. It's not the engine that drives the book, but it's the gasoline that drives the engine that drives the book. Finding out what's in that tanker, who's got it, and what happens if it falls into the wrong hands. And that's always in my books. As you know from reading Caitlin Strong, as you know from reading anything I've written, there is always somebody out there who is looking to do something terrible. The difference in this case is that it's not a foreign power. The threat is coming from within the country. And if it's successful, the country will be radically changed for history.
That's scary, let me tell you. And the book is so nice. I finally got a hardcover for the first time. Yay.
And I put it in the mail. All you had to do was ask. Let's not make that a habit with all the people, hopefully, who are listening today, because then I won't make any – then the book won't sell any copies because I'll be giving them all away.
Well, I've got one, and they can't have it. Too bad.
All right. Good. There you go.
You should see the pile on my desk. It's taller than I am. But, okay, now we've got – my favorite character, another one, is Robert Brixton.
Mm-hmm.
What's his background? And we're learning about Mac, and what did he about Alexandria? Oh, God. He didn't know about her.
Well, you know, two questions. So let's start with the first. I inherited Robert Brixton from my predecessor, Don Bain, who had taken over five or six books before when Margaret Truman, Harry Truman's daughter, who conceived the Capital Crime series, passed away. And then Don passed away.
Mm.
So I inherited Robert Brixton. I didn't create him. But I thought there was an untapped reservoir in Robert Brixton, that Don Bain established him as working for this shadowy State Department security arm called CITQAL. I wanted to take him to the next level. I wanted to make him the kind of character that Vince Flynn writes, the kind of character that Brad Thor writes, Brad Taylor writes, the former special operator who's still in the game. So I made him, I expanded his role, and I made him pretty much in his past what people like that actually do. And I really got into his status as a special operator, his training. There's a great scene. My favorite scene, every book I have a favorite scene that nobody else will talk about. But my favorite scene in this book is the one where his grandson, who's narrowly escaped death in a shooting on the Capitol steps, calls him Poppy. It's his grand. So the idea is, this is an action hero. He's 55 and he's a grandfather, Robert Brixton. And his grandson says, "Will you teach me how to shoot?" And
that was really good.
And then Brixton goes into this exchange where the kid is asking him honest questions about what he did. Have you ever killed anybody? And, you know, what does it feel like? And that scene is so revealing and so it's empathetic, but it's also revealing in the sense that you get to know so much about Brixton. And the fact that he's being honest with this 15-year-old boy who almost died, his grandson, mixed-race kid, it has pathos. It has heart. And I think the problem with thrillers that I don't like is that they lack heart. The thing I think that's wonderful about the genre, the thing that I think keeps people coming back, is not the action. It isn't even scenes like a disappearing tanker in the prologue. Sure, that's part of it. But what really keeps people coming back to the best thriller writers and the best thrillers is a sense of heart, a sense of who these people are. This is why you're seeing so many, you know, so many people imitating or creating their own versions of Jack Reacher. You know, the haunted, although, you know, the thing about Jack Reacher is he isn't haunted at all. He does what he does. He's the most brilliant character in modern fiction, not just of any kind. But I'm talking about characters like Evan Smoke, the Nowhere Man, formerly Orphan X, created by Greg Hurwitz. Characters who are haunted by something. The lone gunman who can't live among men. They try. But it never works any more than Dirty Harry, the Clint Eastwood character, can live among men. So there's a classic thriller concept there that I get into with Brixton. Now, with the second part of your question, Brixton's best friend and the person who's really helped his career along as an international private investigator is Mackenzie Smith, a high-powered Washington lawyer. And again, what's the key word for today's interview? Heart. Mackenzie Smith finds out he has a daughter from an affair he had 25 years before. And he wants this girl to be his daughter so much because he lost a child in a drunk driving accident. So this is his chance this is his chance at redemption. This is his chance, he's getting a second chance at being a father. And he wants this girl to be his young lady, she's 25, 26, Alexandra. He wants it to be true so much he doesn't have objectivity. So he asks Brixton to meet with her and vet her and investigate her to make sure she is who she says he is and who she says she is and who Mac wants her to be. Now, key thing about thrillers, for me, the emotional core, the heart of the book, always intersects with the structural core of the book, the skeleton, in other words, the flesh and the bones. Well, Brixton meets with Alexander, and one of the things he learns in their lunch is that something is bothering her. She works for the CDC, and she's come into some information which terrifies her, but she can't share it with Brixton. She asks for his advice. So what's great about that is there was one meeting for the agenda when they started their lunch, but by the end of the lunch, it's changed entirely. And that's what's great about when you can surprise yourself, because that's not something I was expecting when I started writing that scene. When you can surprise yourself, so many of the people who read my books, they read so many thrillers. They've seen it all. They can almost write the scenes for me. I don't even need to write them. So I have to keep, friend, I got to keep surprising myself. Because if I don't, when you read a John Land book, you're going to know, all right, Brixton's going to interview this girl. There's going to be some secret in her past. And that's going to be, but that's not the direction the book goes in. Sure, we see Mac not struggling with fatherhood, but embracing it. Wanting this. And Brixton knows it's Mac's daughter right from the start because of their eyes. They have the same eyes, the exact same eyes. And Brixton knows that Mac knew that, but he just needed the affirmation. So the scene takes on a different context. And again, we're off and running. I can't stress enough that one of the marks of a good thriller is, number one, it has heart. And number two, that heart is directly connected to what's going on in the story. The fact that Brixton's grandson was almost killed on the Capitol steps is directly related. Not necessarily the fact that he's Brixton's grandson that he's there, but the shooter, the reason why he's shooting at a bunch of high school kids at the time. Why were high school kids targeted in this Capitol steps shooting? Well, that's for Brixton and his partner in this particular book, former Baltimore homicide detective Kelly Loftus. That's what they have to determine, and that's the fun of the book.
Yeah, I like her, though. I wasn't sure at first, but I like her. They let her go from the Baltimore Police Department.
Right.
Now she's there. Now she's there. Right. She's going to work there.
She's a Capitol policeman.
Yeah, she's really good, though. So why is Senator Birch there?
You mean
then he becomes involved, Brixton, too.
You know, if you always tell the truth, you never have to remember what you said. And I think one of the weaknesses thrillers have, and that I have, is that we create these cardboard characters like Senator Byron Fitch.
Yeah.
Who kind of reappear in all my books. They all they're just different names. And these characters are not the characters driving the action. They're involved in it, but they're peripheral, and they're not buffoons, but they're so hateable because they're so jaded in there. They have no values. All they care about is power and money. In other words, they're a typical politician, right? Okay, so that's why. So this guy Fitch he's a guy who wants to be president, who's been hiding his true views. Elected as an independent in a Democratic state of Maryland as a senator. He's kind of pretending to be something he's not, so when the time is right, he can reveal his true colors and help this conspiratorial movement take over the government.
Well, I couldn't put this down. Had a FedEx, printed out for me, made it easier because the font was larger. Seriously, and the book weighed more than I do, but that's okay. So how does Kelly become involved in this shooting? Now this was really good.
Yeah,
There's a woman on the bench.
Yeah.
And she won't say who she is, but when she says something at the end before she leaves, before she finds her, it's like, what?
Yeah. And the fun part of that scene is, as a thriller writer, I'm always looking for new challenges for the characters I create, new ways they can get to the truth. And investigations, again, thriller writers are very savvy. They're very experienced. They're very smart. They've seen it all. If you want them to keep buying your books, you've got to give them something new. You've got to give them something more. So in this case, this woman who's dazed and kind of in shock over what's happened on the Capitol steps, because she knows who did it and she knows why. And so she basically walks away in a daze.
Yeah.
But she has this old ripped handbag. And as she's walking, things are falling out of the handbag. Now Kelly, the former Baltimore police detective, is now with Protective Services for the Capitol Police. She follows a trail, picking up notes and cards and pieces of paper that have been run over, but that have tire tracks on them and that have coffee stains. And then she has to reconstruct. And I had never done something like this before. And here's something else, and I love coming on your show, Fran, because first of all, I get an hour, and so I can really talk, which is good because I talk a lot, and I like talking. But the thing about it is I had never done something like this, kind of a National Treasure Nicolas Cage movies thing where a character is putting a puzzle, literally putting a word puzzle together. And there's a great moment. And again, everything is about building up to something. Good thrillers build. Great thrillers pay off. In Murder at the CDC, it's the line when she figures out that the one of the missing pieces is 5 million dead. What does she know? That somehow this woman on the courthouse, who's on the great lawn of the Capitol, who knows the shooter who just murdered, who just killed 18 people, wounded more. She is somehow aware through this handwritten note that Kelly Loftus, the cop, reconstructs, that 5 million people minimum are going to die. Or millions. I forgot whether I put a number on it. Or it's just millions will die. Well, how are they going to die? And then what do we come back to? We come back to that tanker that disappeared in the prologue. You can see the problem with the dangling, I call it the dangling prologue, even in Cussler's books, was sometimes by the time you got back to the MacGuffin that was introduced, before the story even starts in the past, by the time you get back to it, so many pages have passed, you've forgotten, and you have to go back and reread. I want, in my thrillers, I like to make that connection much more intrinsic and much more seamless and also faster. So right away, when the reader knows stuff, and here's the fun of thrillers, the reader knows things the characters don't. Kelly Loftus does not know about the tanker. Brixton does not know at this point stage of the book. He is going to learn about it, but he doesn't know about it now. So you're left. So, and here's the real fun thing. And I'm just realizing this myself. Here's the real fun thing. As Kelly Loftus is assembling a puzzle for herself, the reader, that's what a thriller does. The reader gives a thriller gives the reader a puzzle and asks them to assemble it. So it's kind of like an interactive adventure in the sense that the reader is doing the same thing that the character is doing, and that's kind of the way I want to create an immersive experience for my readers to make them not only feel like that they're there, but they're playing along with the characters. They're assembling the clues at the same and trying to figure out the connections. What does a Baltimore high school have to do with all this, where 7 kids were poisoned? That's a different school than the one that gets shot up on the Capitol steps. But how did 7 high school students die within a few hours of each other in a single day? What do they have in common? You see, great thrillers raise questions that you have to keep reading to get the answers to. But then the best thrillers never let you down with those answers. They don't say you don't want the reveal of something you've been building to be anticlimactic. That is a crucial thing if you're writing. The worst thing a writer can be in the thriller genre is anticlimactic, because you've let the reader down. And there's an old saying in this business, let the reader down, they'll never buy you again. I just made it up, so it's not so old, but it's true.
Well, you should read the last 5 thriller books I have to interview people with, and Root Canal was more fun.
Well, you know something?
It's sad, because I figured out who did it on the first page. I figured out right away.
That's really a problem. And you know what it comes down to? M. Night Shyamalan, the director and writer, wrote and directed The Sixth Sense, the great movie with Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
He was terrified that the viewers would figure out that Bruce Willis was dead so early in the movie that it would be no fun. But he so magically misdirects our attention that we never even suspect what the big reveal is, because we're putty in the director's hands. The same way we're putty in the hands of a master magician. I watch America's Got Talent for one reason when it's on. I watch it for the magicians and the mentalists. They do things that are impossible. I don't care when people say go on YouTube and they'll explain how they did the trick. It makes me want, is this real? Is this really magic? Is this person really able to do what he or she says that they're doing? Because what's the other explanation? A thriller writer is like a magician. We don't want you to see something too early, so we have to distract you from it. You know, we don't want you figuring things out too fast. Because if you beat Brixton and Loftus to the end, to the solution, then you're smarter than they are. And by nature, the characters you're reading need to be smarter than you, or you should be the hero of the book instead of them.
Mm. This was really complex. I loved it. But this part really interested me, because when there's any kind of science or anything different, I have to look it up too. Mm-hmm. So we meet Ephraim, and he goes along with him and his son to the greenhouse, and we learn about that was so cool, white death, which I'm not going to say why that's important, because it's going to be helpful to figure out something.
I think that's actually one of my favorite little things, smaller things in the book, not so small.
Yeah.
The notion that there are so many plants, flowers specifically, that have these deadly toxins. We're always looking for ultimate weapons in the lab. Well, sometimes the ultimate weapon is right under our nose.
Mm.
In this case, the white death, which is what's in that tanker, comes from orchids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a genetically enhanced compound, which is basically deadly in any number of ways. You can do it transdermally. You can inhale it. You could swallow it. It's unlimited. It's one of those super weapons and the thing that makes it special is it can be targeted. You could only go after one part of the country and not the other by how you release the poison, by how you release the toxin.
Mm.
And, of course, this plays right into the villain's hands, because they don't want an indiscriminate weapon. They want a selective weapon so they can attack the parts of the country that they want to attack.
That's scary. So how do they learn the name of the shooter? And I love this kid. You got to bring him back. I love this kid. He's so me, because I get involved in everything and get in trouble all the time.
Uh-huh.
So how does Robert's grandson become involved, and what information does he share? And I just had an idea for a panel after.
That's good. Well, I mentioned before that he's nearly a victim. So his role is to get Brixton into the plot, is to bring Brixton in. Now, at that point, there's no way we can know that what Alexandra, Mackenzie Smith's long-lost daughter, is chasing is ultimately the same thing Brixton is chasing. It's just a different avenue that she's taking to get to it. And what he learns from his grandson in the same scene I mentioned before where he's telling the grandson the truth about who he is, who he really is, that very few people know. He learns that the shooter was targeting them. He aimed that gun. It wasn't random. He didn't just shoot up the Capitol steps. He was aiming left, right. He was aiming right to left across the steps, and starting with these high school students, and then following them as the survivors. So, you know, now, again, misdirection. Is that really what's going on? I'm not saying. It only appears to be what's going on. It's kind of a red herring. And it's also, you know, there are, you got to be very, very careful. There are some things that are taboo, even in thrillers. And killing kids is tough. Now, these are high school kids, so they're not little kids. But still, but here's the problem. We think by ignoring or having these unwritten rules that we can't do certain things, we want to convince ourselves that bad things really don't happen. That there aren't really people out there who would do this. There aren't really people out there. You want to know something? There are. And that's what this book gets to.
They are. If you read the news lately, there are. Every other day is a high school murder or some kind of shooting. It scares me.
You know,
this book is coming out on
the anniversary.
It scares me.
Isn't the anniversary of Parkland today or yesterday?
I know.
There's the shooting in Parkland. And, you know, let's digress briefly. This country, I won't use the word I want to use because it's a PG-13 show. But
yeah,
this country is so this country is so messed up. In the wake of that tragedy at Parkland, those high school seniors and some younger than high school seniors like David Hogg and I forgot the name of that Celine Gomez was I think her last name. She had a crew cut. You listen to these 18 and 17 and 16 year old kids talk. And boy, could we learn a lot from that. And you want to know the dregs of humanity, the dreck, the crap, the feces we should just roll out in the trash. Look at the people on certain networks, in certain media, who vilified those children. Those survivors for arguing against gun rights. They made them villains. They stalked them. And I'm talking about the same mentality. The same people who did that to those Parkland kids are the people who are capable of anything if it achieves their ends. And that's the mentality I'm exploring in Murder at the CDC, the factions and tribalism in this country, and how far one side will go to get what they want. Whether they have to lie, steal, cheat, kill, it doesn't matter. It unfolds every day before our eyes. Right in front of us, we're seeing it. And you want to know something, Fran? Let's just call a spade here, okay? Let's just come out and just say it. If you think that pizza joints are fronts for pedophile rings where kids are being trafficked in basements by Democrats and politicians, and if you're in Dealey Plaza in Dallas for 5 weeks waiting for JFK Jr. and his father to magically reappear, you're a moron. You're a moron, and you're destructive, and your thoughts are destructive, and these are not harmless people. These are the same people who would shoot up Capitol steps because they heard a voice in their head. Because that's what JFK Jr. wanted them to do. Because JFK Jr. is going to rise from the dead and stand alongside Donald Trump in vanquishing the pedophile rings that are in the basements of pizza parlors. And oh, by the way, did you know
that's
the California wildfires were started by space lasers from Israel?
Yeah.
People believe this crap. How about Alex Jones and his followers, which number in the millions, that believe Sandy Hook, the shooting in Sandy Hook, not too far from where either one of us are right now, was fabricated. Those weren't really kids who died. They were Hollywood actors. That wasn't blood. That was just makeup. That was just special effects. There are people in this country who are so deluded. That they live in their own brand of reality. They create their own reality to justify their hatred and their misanthropic, small thinking. They're despicable. They're absolutely despicable.
What gets me is that some of them have so much money that they actually get away with it. And that's what bothers me even more.
No, what's worse
money,
is...
Money talks.
No. What's worse is the fact that smart people with money will back them to get power.
That's exactly it.
It's a con job because these people are so stupid and moronic, they can be conned so easily. You know, it's like, you know, they're the ones who'd buy, if they had any money, they'd buy property in Florida, you know, swampland. You know, it's kind of like if – it used to be – and I don't know – the mentality that I'm trying to get at in Murder at the CDC – is, and maybe this, it's become so pervasive in our country that if you lose, you still get a trophy. If you fail a test, you get to take it over. If you lose an election, well, then somebody stole it because you couldn't have possibly lost it. Your guy couldn't possibly have lost. So because you can't face that reality, you have to invent your own reality. And so, you know what? There's something about losing, and I've lost more than I've won in my life. And when you're in the book business and the movie business, it's kind of like living in a world where you get rejected. The girl you want to take to the senior prom turns you down every day. That's the world I live in. I would love the fact that I could get do-overs. That when I pitched Netflix on Caitlin Strong and I was terrible. Boy, I wish I could. Can I do that again tomorrow? No, you don't get that in reality. You know, or maybe I should have gone down to Dallas and waited for JFK to magically reappear, you know, and where he was shot all those years ago. You know, what drives these people? And there were hundreds of them there cheering and waiting. Whenever a siren went by, they were like, they really believed that JFK was coming back. And a person that deluded, and this is what I'm getting at in Murder the CDC.
It's scary.
These are the people. What happens if people like that took power? What would happen if they were mobilized and used and conned to be that army on the front lines to almost like a crusade? Because that's what this is right now. It's a cult. It's not politics. It's a cult. You know, it's the cult of personality. And just like I didn't understand how anyone could follow a loser like James, what's his name, the Jonestown guy. James Jones or whatever it was. I never understood people like that. I don't understand weakness. I don't understand that kind of weakness because it's so foreign to me. You have to be honest with people, but most of all, you have to be honest with yourself.
That's the problem. Most people aren't, and they're delusional. So we've got another character that I really like. That's Panama.
Oh, I love Panama.
And he comes into the picture with Ephraim, and where does he take him? And why did you create the scenes that deal with the beginning of the book? I was like, that is so freaking cool.
Well, again, confession time. What drives thrillers is forward momentum. But there are always times where you hit a wall, or you're going to hit a wall, where the character, your hero, cannot learn any. He's exhausted all his resources to get the information that he has. So there's a classic thriller trope of the mysterious stranger. He's not the lone gunman. He's the mysterious man who appears out of nowhere with answers to questions. And he works for shadowy people, or he doesn't work for anyone at all. Panama is a fixer in the sense that, you know, he comes into a situation to decide who gets jurisdiction. Who's the right people to take this big thing on? And you realize in both Murder on the Metro, the first book where you meet him, and Brixton names him Panama because he wears a Panama hat and a khaki suit all the time. You know, he actually is very powerful. You know, he commands incredible. He doesn't answer to anyone. He's a minister without portfolio. So he can do whatever he wants because he doesn't carry an ID card or a badge in his wallet. He's one of these characters In the old days, it would probably be called Deus Ex Machina. God, the writer is God, in the sense that he comes in and answers questions. The reader needs the answers, and more importantly, Brixton needs the answers. And he comes in to the book. He's kind of a character who just shows up in places. He shows up in the greenhouse because now he's been listening to this whole conversation, and now they think they found the White Death. They think they found the missing tanker. Well, they find the missing tanker, but there's nothing left inside it. So somebody, Fran, sucked out the White Death from the tanker, and now it's out there. It's at large. Somebody's got it.
What scares me is that somebody got this stupid virus, and it's out there, too, and it's never going away either. And it cracks me up that they're lifting all these bans and stuff. Wait till the pandemic gets worse again when they lift all the masks and stuff. They have no idea. So we've got another character that I'm not crazy about, Deacon Frank.
Ah.
Tell us about him. And you know something, I reported child abuse when I was an educator. I would have probably slammed him a long time ago.
Well,
and
you know,
I don't
something?
Like him. And he justifies himself, too. That's what gets me.
Deacon Frank, and they call him, his name is Deacon Frank, Frank Wilhite, they call him his name, but he goes by Deacon Frank because he was as a young boy, he was a quote, deacon in his televangelist father's church. And I think Deacon Frank is one of the greatest villains I've ever created because he's so rich and so deep and so vulnerable to his own emotions. One of the things that happens is he despises the memory of his father, his late father. His father was killed in a robbery of the church. So he despises his father. And then he realizes he's becoming his father. And his relationship with his son is one of the key beats in the book, in Murder at the CDC. Because his son is a bullied kid, but in the course of the writing, in the course of the story, Deacon Frank comes to realize his kid is this closet, you know, scientific savant. And then the kid, it turns out, can help Deacon Frank weaponize the White Death, whereas everyone else has failed. The kid has already proven there's a way to make it work because he's done it.
I did.
So you didn't know that early on. So again, these are not, a lot of these things I didn't know when I started writing the book, but this was one of those books that really came together for me. And Deacon Frank lives in the shadow of his famous father, the Reverend Rand Atlas Wilhite. And I think that's a very something people can relate to. Living in the shadow of your father or your mother, it's something you never really get over. And then the guy dies and Deacon Frank inherits all this money. Well, what's he going to do with it? Well, he grew up among the kind of people in the backwater towns in rural America whose values, I don't know what's happening to these people. And you know these are the people in, not all of them, but these are the people in Dallas waiting for JFK to come back. So he knows, he grew up in the midst of these people, and he knows how to manipulate them. He knows how to con them. He knows he wants to outdo his father. He wants to become bigger and more powerful than his father. He wants to leave his mark, and the way he's going to leave his mark is by utilizing the White Death to do something that is so awful, and yet, in his mind, it's the right thing to do. And that's the scary thing about villains. Villains believe what they're doing is just.
Yeah, they justify it.
They justify it, but it's not. They're not. They may be lying to themselves, but they buy into their lie.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about liars. A lot of times, the first person they con is themselves. And that's the thing. You con yourself, you know. And it's if somebody calls you up and says to you, "Congratulations, Fran, you won $100,000.
Yeah, right.
You won
I've gotten
the publisher's
that.
almost clearinghouse sweepstakes. And you're how happy are you right now? I just told you $100,000. And you know what, friend?
I wouldn't quite buy it.
I have the check. You just got to send me the taxes in advance. Send me $5,000, and I'll wire you. As soon as I get it, I'm going to wire you $100,000 because I've got to pay the taxes up front. These are the kind of people.
That's right.
Who would wire the $5,000 because they want to believe. They believe the lie. They believe the con. And it's mind-boggling that you could believe space lasers and you could believe pedophile pizza joints and you could believe Sandy Hook was a joke, but there are millions of people in this country who are susceptible to this cultish, thuggish behavior with this parade of clowns. You know, the car pulls up and they all get out of the car. You know, the Alex Joneses, you know, and, you know, I could go on forever. The O'Keefes, you know, the people who twist the truth and fabricate stories to create the reality they want. They don't care. And then they convince others that that reality is real, not something they created. And I don't know what's worse, them or the people who follow them.
Both. Because the people that follow them get other people that follow them. But before I forget, Thursday, award-winning author Cindy McDonald will be here with her next Fiona Quinn. And on the 21st, the author of Fool Me Once. Now on the 23rd, John, somebody we know and love, John Gilstrap, Blue Fire.
Oh, my friend John Gilstrap. Hopefully you're having him on early.
Yes, 10 o'clock.
So, okay, that's good because, John is – talk about great action writers. John is just awesome. His Jonathan Graves character, who's a hostage negotiator, one of the best in the business. And you know what I love about John? He's been doing this about as long as I have. Through all the ups and downs and twists and turns, John Gilstrap has hung in there, and he's still writing great books.
This is different. This is the second in the series that I read.
Yeah, this
and
is
this
the new
is
series.
About,
the
what would you do
hero.
Without electricity, without cars, without stoves? What if you lived in a land where if you don't work, you don't eat? This is so fantastic. And on the 28th, I am like shocked. New York Times author Claire Douglas will be here with Just Like Us Other Girls. On the 2nd, Wayward Assassin. On the 3rd, Driven. And on the 8th, Wait Till I Get Him on the Air. Philip Margolin, The Darkest Place. I won't tell you why, but he did something that made me cry. That's all I will say. And on the 10th, yes, wait till you see what happened. Yes, when people do that. And Andrea Kane at Any Cost on the 10th. And that's just part of March. Don't forget Nancy Allen on the 15th. So I've got a lot of people coming up, and there's going to be a couple of weeks where I have 3 in a row. Oh, my God. So what do the parents of the school where the children were killed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my niece was part of the Parkland thing. Her school was right next door. They had to lock it down for hours. They had to sit under tables and stuff. It was horrible, she said. So what do you learn from the parents of the students and this principal? He had no choice but to cooperate, but he couldn't figure out what happened. What's wrong with these people?
Well, again, thrillers are puzzles. They're quests. They're journeys. And in this case, there has to be a connection for those seven kids because they all die the same day. They were poisoned, but nobody knows what, with, or how.
Yeah.
So by interviewing their parents, and these are really hard scenes to read and write because you're dealing with grief. But the fun part of that grief in this case is that the pictures that Brixton and Loftus, because they divide them up, so you see them going back and forth. They see them. There are clues that they get along the way, and one of those clues becomes crucial in the investigation into the existence of the White Death and who has it. Because what you realize, again, this is the connections you make in thrillers. And some people will call a writer like me manipulative because in the end everything connects. No, life is not always like that. Not everything always connects. But in thrillers, it does. So the fun part of reading a thriller like Murder at the CDC isn't if all this stuff is connected. You use the word how complicated or complex the book is. It's not if, it's how. How do all these pieces, these disparate strands, knit together? How do they come together? And that's the definition of what a thriller is. It takes all these disparate pieces of a story and joins them together. One of the differences, and I've never said it this way before, so we got to hold on to this one. One of the differences between a thriller and a mystery is, for the most part, a mystery is only following one strand. It's following something that happened and the detective that's investigating it. By the way, that's not a bad thing. Anyone who reads Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch or Renee Ballard books knows that one strand is all you need if in the right hands. But in my books, there are multiple strands and multiple plot lines and multiple POVs. And the fun is watching them and trying to figure out how they link, how they connect, how they join up.
That's scary. So this is a question right here. A few minutes. How did you create all the scenes to describe the toxins, Deegan, Frank, Panama, and Brixton, and how did you connect them, and how did you include the senator? I'm going to leave out one word because that will give away who did it. Can't do that.
Well, first off, thrillers, and there is no scenes I enjoy writing more, especially in my Caitlin Strong series, but I've carried that over into the Capital Crime series, that when the hero finally confronts the villain. Finally confronts the villain, and each of them knows they're playing chess or checkers in some cases, because the hero knows the villain, what the villain is doing, but they haven't got proof yet, or they haven't figured everything out. And the villain knows why the hero is there, to get more information. I think another scene that I love in this book, the first scene between Brixton and Deacon Frank, where Deacon Frank gives him a tour of his dairy farm, the cows and all this.
Yeah.
And there's so much understated in that scene, stuff that isn't said. Those kind of scenes are an awful lot of fun because you build to them. It's especially fun with Caitlin because often she's a woman confronting a powerful man. And that's a whole different dynamic than the Brixton scenes because it's two men. So I have so much fun with those kind of scenes, because there's conflict. See, conflict drives thrillers. Every scene, you need to be able to define what are the characters, even if they agree with each other, what is this scene about? Each scene needs its own beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm.
So what is driving each scene in terms of resolution? And one of the other things, you know, there's also a great twist in the end of Murder at the CDC we won't get into. You know, kind of like maybe they don't get the bad guy the way you think they are, but they got to find another way if they don't do it the more traditional way. So it's kind of fun. And here's the bottom line. I had so much fun writing this book. I write nonfiction, I write fiction. Nonfiction is not fun. Nonfiction is not fun.
I know.
Nonfiction is a skill. Fiction is an art. I enjoy writing nonfiction. I love writing fiction because I surprise myself when I write fiction. I don't surprise myself when I write nonfiction because I'm writing in somebody else's voice. I'm writing their book. I'm not writing my book. It becomes my book. And don't get me wrong, I love the process, but in a different way and not nearly as much as writing fiction. The problem is that fiction is very, very tough to crack right now as far as making a living. Books aren't selling as many copies as they used to. And if you're not on the New York Times bestseller list, you need a day job. And if you don't want a day job, you better be able to write more than just fiction. And I'm actually going to talk about this in a class at Thriller Fest coming up in June this year. You know, about do you want to be a writer, or do you want to make a living as a writer? And those are two entirely different things. And maybe the difference is writer versus author. Are you in this business to pay the mortgage? Are you doing this to pay the mortgage? Or are you doing it because you want to see your name in print? Or is it both? For me, let's face it, it's both. Nobody enjoys seeing their name on a book cover more than I do. And that's as much a driver as anything else. If you don't get a chill or really the first time you see a book cover or that finished book, there's nothing more magical. And I've done 58 books. I think Murder at the CDC might be 58 or 59, so I'm coming up on 60. And I'm still as excited today as I was. I mean, going back to 1983, publication of my first book in April of 83, The Doomsday Spiral, when I knew I was going to see, you know, I was getting my copies the next day, the first time I'd ever seen a published book with my name on it, I couldn't sleep the night before. I literally could not fall asleep. That's how excited I was. Now, I do sleep now on the day before I'm going to see a book for the first time, but it's still magical. And I guess what it comes down to is this. As long as the process, I still have that kind of wide-eyed approach to my books, that I, you know, that as long as I feel that way about them, then the reader will feel that way about them. And you have to be, as a writer, you have to be your own best friend, and you have to be your own number one fan. Because if you don't like what you're writing, if you don't love what you're writing, don't expect anyone else to like it or love it. They won't.
You're right.
You have to love it. You have to be able to read it and go, I would buy this book if someone else had written it, and I would love it. If you can't say those things, something's wrong with what you're writing.
I agree with you, except I got a nasty review the other day, and I think it was planted. I think I know who planted it.
Hey, I wrote a book, the last book I did with Random House, with Fawcett Gold Medal, was Vengeance of the Tau. My ninth Blaine McCracken, sixth or seventh Blaine McCracken book. And Publishers Weekly, in those days, I was mass market paperback only, and maybe I got one or two reviews. Publishers Weekly said about that book, Land manages to offend practically everyone in this unintentionally hilarious thriller.
No, this person didn't even read the book. She just said it wasn't worth buying it on Amazon, and I hated it. I didn't answer anything. I just ignored it.
No, never go at it. The best worst review I ever read or heard of was a review of one of MJ Rose, my good friend MJ Rose's books, where the reviewers on Amazon said, not only did I hate this book, if it were possible to go back and unread it, I would do it.
Mm-hmm. She doesn't like me. I reviewed her books, but I don't know. They don't love me anymore, but that's okay.
They don't know what they're missing.
That's right. You know, it's funny. This week alone, yesterday, I got five people whose books I reviewed years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, I don't remember, and they said, the book is in the mail. I go, how'd you know where to put it? I mean, one I felt so bad, honored. The book came from Ireland yesterday. And I'm like, why did he send me? And I read it this morning. It's like 150 pages. I read it this morning. It's called The Unlucky Charm by Aidan Lucid. It's really good. It's for YAs. It's really, really good. It's not bad.
I love the title.
Yeah, it's about a stopwatch that somebody got, that this kid got for his mother, and it creates danger and death. That's all I will say.
The old Twilight Zone MacGuffin.
Yeah,
you know.
I love the Twilight Zone. So where do you see my friend Robert next? What's going to happen next? I want Caitlin Strong, people.
I'm not. You know, I haven't thought about the next Brixton book yet, to be honest. Working on some things with Capital Crimes. Before I move on to do the next book, it's a very competitive market, and you know, it's like I need a new formula to make the books not just work as books, get into more bookstores and get better display. It's such a challenge today to be one of those authors that is. A household name, you know. Everybody in this business wants to be Lee Child, but there's only one Lee Child. You know, and he's not giving up the space. Huh?
One of my favorite people. He doesn't ask me to review anything. I'm, like, surprised.
Well, he's one of my favorite people. One of my favorite people in the world and one of the nicest people I know.
Publicist a while ago, and she said, you could buy it. I said, that's not my job. You're supposed to send it to me.
Yeah,
she was kind of like, okay, what can I say? So if you bring Brixton back, are you going to bring Kelly back and Panama?
That's a very good question.
And Max, too. Don't forget him.
And Max always going to be there. That's a very good question. And I think the answer, you know, so far I've done two books and there have been two different female leads.
I know.
The trend in publishing with the great books by Lisa Gardner and Lisa Scottolini often is if you have a hero, you know, it's usually two. It's usually a man and a woman. Sometimes it's two women. Sometimes it's two men. Nate Romanowski and Joe Pickett in the great C.J. Box, Game Warden books. So it can be anything. But normally there are two, and normally Dave Robichaux and Cleet Purcell. Normally you have the same ones in every book. So I may very well bring Loftus back because I feel that there's more I can do with her, just like there's more I can do.
Yeah, you can.
And the interesting thing about a man and having a male and a female as the leads, because Brixton's engaged to another woman, there's really no sexual tension between them. And I like that because I think that it's overdone. That why is it that every time a man and a woman are together, it has to be romantic? No, that's not the way the world is. Why can't we respect women enough that they can stand toe to toe with a man and be their associates, their contemporaries, not just lovers, or develop into that? And that's what I love about Kelly. She's very independent. And let's face it, Fran, something we haven't touched on. She's just like Brixton, even more than Brixton. She's a rule breaker. She should have given up that evidence. She should have given up that evidence she found on the trail of that woman who got away. She should have turned it over to the FBI. But she doesn't. Why? She didn't even totally understand why herself, because that's her nature. She's like a pit bull when it comes to investigations. And it's important for her to redeem herself after what happened to her in Baltimore. This is what I'm talking about. It's creating full range of characters. And why I think Kelly could be a recurring character who could come back. Maybe not as a Capitol policeman. You know, maybe she's working for Panama, but that might be a little, that might have worked for one book, but I don't know if it would work for more. So the challenge
She might work for a standalone too, because she's really good. And I don't like too many characters lately. Yeah, I'm going to be interviewing somebody next month. I won't say which book it is, but I really wish she would kill off the main character and never bring her back ever. Because she was
That's going to be a
an
tough
investigator,
interview.
But she would be interesting, right? I have to be nice too. Yeah. She created a character that is so obnoxious and so nasty, and beat up her clients and beat up the people that she was investigating. That I wanted to beat her up also because I don't like her. So
why do we root for her? Why do we?
Yeah, I'm going to root to get rid of her.
Why are we rooting for her?
I just, like, I couldn't stand her. Oh, God.
I'm confused.
I've got so many. And I started to write another book, and I just decided to tear it up because I don't like it. I was going to write a sequel to Population Zero. It was going to be called The Last Grave. And I decided, I wrote the scene. The scene itself is great. So I decided to change the title to base it on a television program that used to be on television a long time ago.
Okay. So, you want to tell us the television program? I'm interviewing
Fantasy
you now.
Fantasy Island, and I'm going to call it Demonic Island.
Oh, God, that's interesting.
If I could figure out how to write it. I started to write it on my phone. I have to find your review on my computer. My computer has a habit of making things disappear.
Oh, kind of like my bank account.
Yes, my bank account disappeared a long time ago. And that's why I type the questions on my phone so they don't disappear. But where can everybody get your books? And
anywhere online, favorite bookstore. If you can't get it, if your store doesn't have it, they can order it.
Well,
you know,
I've got a panel on the 7th of April. I forgot what it's all about. Yeah. Oh, Settings and Story. Alan Topol, Stephen Harms, and a whole bunch of people are going to talk about how the setting of their story is educational. I just made it up.
Hmm.
It's a, yeah, that's going to be fun. And then, I, you know, as you said, investigations, and I like what you said last, I wonder how many, if you and Vincent Zandri and a few others would talk about, do I want to be an author, a writer, or do I want a career, or do I just want to see my name in print? That's interesting. I wonder how many people would actually, you know, talk about that. Because a lot of the, or Vincent just signed a contract for a book a month. And he signed, and Dick just signed three with for Claire Carlson, and for Dana Perry. And you'll probably, I can't wait for you to write the next one. Caitlin,
well,
show people.
I can't write through. You know, it's good taking a little break though, because it'll make people, it'll make me want to write her all the more.
That's exactly right. So everybody, it's beautiful outside. My car's in repair, so I can't go anywhere. Yeah, it's so sad. But it's 21 degrees in Westchester. It's warm. This is a heat wave. Yesterday was minus 7. John, thank you so much. Everybody, stay safe. Do something kind for somebody, and then maybe the virus will take a hike and all the nasty people will disappear because they're not welcome. So have a great day, and bye.
Bye, friend.